Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ecology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and we'll be with you for the next hour on this November the 27th on the West Coast, now November the 28th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to welcome all those listening to tonight's show on Wind Talkers Radio Network, as well as BlogTalkRadio.com. We're going to cut straight to the chase tonight. We have been following with tonight's guest a path that he has laid out, describing many of the ancient technologies and secrets about our reality that have a direct impact on our consciousness and how we perceive things going on today. Our guest is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, teacher, and our, I like to say, resident science advisor. And he is my regular Friday night guest, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Don. It's good to be here as usual. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was very nice. Thank you for asking. How was yours?
It was good. It was good. I didn't get to go east this year, but I had a very nice celebration with some friends locally, and it was fun.
Oh, that's good. That's always great when you can be with somebody you enjoy being with, even though you're away from home. So
it is.
Well, that's something to be thankful for, I guess, right? Just that alone.
Yes.
Well, we've gotten sidetracked in a positive way with your planned presentation of hidden technologies and hidden unknown facts about mankind's origin and many of the civilizations that preceded the one we're in right now, if that's a proper description of what we're experiencing. And I know that you have some other points that you want to get out. So get out of your system or get the word out is what I mean. I want to allow you the opportunity to continue with that.
All right. Well, that will be good. And there is quite a list. So even if we don't cover it all, we can always continue with it in the next show. We had been talking about, as you mentioned, various aspects of history and mystery and technology, which the general public probably is not aware of. And the purpose of doing this was to demonstrate the fact that knowing these things and contemplating them and pondering the realization that they are real could have a very expanding effect on consciousness, which, of course, had been our goal in giving demonstrations for that now for about 2 months. And so I guess we'll just continue in that vein. One of the most interesting ideas along this line, which has been brought up many times, in the last 50 or 60 years especially, has been the Hall of Records. There was the sleeping prophet Edgar Cayce, who talked about many of these things, and he used to get his information in these visions and I don't know what else you would call them, altered states, I guess, while he was sleeping. And one of the messages that came through him quite frequently was this idea that there is a hidden chamber beneath the Sphinx on the Giza Plateau in Egypt, which essentially contains records etched or otherwise imprinted on gold plates, which define the true history of mankind and his purpose on this planet. And there were supposedly three places on Earth where duplicates of these records had been deposited. One was in Egypt, beneath the Sphinx. The other was somewhere in South America. The exact location was never disclosed. And the third place was in one of the temples in the continent of Atlantis, which, of course, is now no longer with us. But it has always been an absolute and total attraction for me that these records might one day be found, simply because of the fact that I think, as I've mentioned on other shows, that the true history of humanity on this planet is far more complicated, convoluted, and ancient than we are led to believe. And it would be absolutely marvelous if that could be proven and if the details could be disclosed. Now, talk about an expansion of consciousness. I think it would be astounding to see the effects that the revelations of our true history would have on the minds of the modern world. So even though I can't give you any great details about that, I certainly can hope that it's a reality and that someday those records will be found and made public. Would certainly be nice. Do you have any comments on that, Don?
Yeah. I've heard some recent discussions in the past couple of years about that very topic. About something being under the Sphinx, and I don't know if they took the cue of Edgar Cayce or it's this just the obsession that, for instance, the Rockefellers have had with discovering what may be hidden there. They've had a lifelong fascination with the Phoenix Rising concept and discovering the secrets of the ancient Egyptians. So it's no big surprise.
Yeah, well, I can tell you one thing, and this may or may not be related to this subject, but as God is my witness, this is a true story. I've had a very strong attraction to all these things all of my life. And you talk about the Sphinx. I remember my grandmother used to use writing paper made by a company called Sphinx. And their hallmark was a picture of the Sphinx on the stationery box. And I used to stare at that thing, and even when I was a young child, I used to stare at that thing and have the most incredible feeling of knowing something about it. But I just could never get it to surface. And so I have been interested in it all my life. Several years ago, there was a special that was aired on the BBC network, and it was hosted by that Egyptian fellow who's in charge of antiquities, Hassan, I can't remember his exact name, and it was an hour long. And it talked about the fact that there was some, I think they were making some repairs or investigating something having to do with one of the paws of the Sphinx and also the hindquarters of the Sphinx. And they found a passageway which had been overlooked previously. And they actually took the camera equipment down into this passage, and it opened up into an enormous room. I mean, it was enormous. That's all I can tell you. I have no real feeling for how big it was, mm-hmm. except for the fact that, you know, a subterranean train station was the impression that you got. Just an enormous room held up by columns. And the thing that was so amazing about it was there were these sarcophagi laid out in this chamber that were above ground. I mean, they weren't in a separate tomb or anything. They were above ground. They were at ground level, let's put it that way, in this subterranean chamber. But each one of them was surrounded by a moat filled with water. And it was just the most amazing thing you could ever imagine. And this guy went on and on about the incredible discovery and what it would lead to and all this kind of thing. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, I have to get a copy of this tape. Because I know that when you have these various presentations, oftentimes they do make copies of that type of thing available. And so I looked for a copy of it, and I unfortunately don't remember the name because it has been quite a few years now since this presentation was aired. But the interesting thing was it was gone. You can't find an ounce of information about this presentation anywhere. I have been looking for it now for well over 10 years, and with your permission, Don, since we have a pretty good-sized audience out there, I would like to ask that if anybody has seen this report on the British Broadcasting System a number of years ago and knows where I can get a copy of that, I would just be holding to you forever, because it's got to have been suppressed and it's got to have been one of the most astounding discoveries of the century. And God only knows what else it led to. Perhaps this very hall of records that we're talking about is part of this subterranean complex. But all I know is, within hours after the show was aired, there was nobody who had any information about it whatsoever. And that seems to me to be an impossibility.
Well, we put that call out to the listeners, if anybody has that. Do you recall the time, approximate time that you saw this broadcast?
It was at least 10 years ago. And the interesting thing was, prior to its actually having been transmitted, it was advertised as a special. You know how they do, but once in a while, and they're going to show you something unusual so that people don't miss it.
Mm-hmm.
They had ads on the various channels about the upcoming show, and that's how I got wind of it. And I watched it, and I was awestruck. And yet, the next day, when I tried to find information about it, nobody knew anything. Now, you know, I'm not the brightest bulb in the box by any stretch of the imagination, but within one day of having watched that, I certainly remembered most of the details, and I wrote down the name at the time, and I wrote down other salient features with the intention of getting a copy of the tape, and it was to no avail. Just couldn't find it. And it's never surfaced again since, to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's something which is really peculiar. And it had to have been suppressed for some reason. The question is, why? Why would you show all of that and then have a change of heart? Unless it led to something really amazing that they don't want you to know. Like, for instance, who was buried in those four or five sarcophagi that were in this subterranean chamber? Who would go through all that trouble of putting these giant sarcophagus down there, surrounded by moats even, filled with water, in this gigantic chamber, unless they represented someone or something of very great importance to the people who built all that stuff. And supposedly, modern archaeology knows all of the chronology of Egyptian rulers, you know, from the beginning of the first dynasty right down the line to the very end of the Egyptian-Roman era, which is quite a few thousand years. So it's just amazing that whoever was buried down there certainly wasn't on the list. Perhaps they were Atlanteans. Perhaps they were individuals of great renown that existed in that region prior to the formation of the dynasties. Whatever it was, I would sure like to know more about it.
Yeah, some of my recent research has entered that realm, as you and I have discussed on a few shows. There's, again, I mentioned the Rockefeller name and their obsession with that ancient history, and it sort of plays into the world politics as well. A lot of secrets there in Egypt, and certainly they were after the alchemical secrets of certain rituals and the esoteric knowledge that's been suppressed, right along, you know, right hand in hand with what we've been talking about.
Well, I'm absolutely certain that they have some of the alchemical information that goes way back, because that knowledge has been made available to various groups throughout the entire recorded history in an underground capacity over the centuries. And it surfaces every now and then, you know, by accident or because somebody decides to spill the beans. But the general information has certainly been restricted to the so-called elite and to certain private organizations. And it makes you wonder, you know, if some of the things that we've heard about, like, for instance, this guy, Count Saint Germain, who supposedly existed for at least 600 years, if any of that is true, and if it was accomplished through the use of alchemical knowledge, then who's to say how long some of these members of secret societies are actually living, while the rest of us are forced to tread the earth for a mere 60 or 70 years. And, you know, that would explain why there's a continuance of these power groups throughout history with such tenacity, is because of the fact that perhaps some of them are living century to century and thereby being capable of passing on information and plans and experiences, you know, in a way that we could never achieve as short-lived mortals.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At any rate, there's more going on than meets the eye in that direction, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I had touched upon that in my research on the long-legged Mac Daddy. In fact, it pointed in that very direction that you're talking about. So even the news items that that made the mainstream media hinted that there was much more beneath the surface than what anyone was alluding to. So certainly we have, I think, in a way, maybe by accident or maybe just by dogged pursuit, we've actually been able to make a determination that there are other things going on that that they wouldn't want us to know about. But in their exuberance to sort of put this right in front of our faces, I think they let out more than they initially intend to let out, which is often the case. But, you know, I'm just speculating there, of course.
Yeah, and I realize that, but still, I tend to agree with what you're saying. And the interesting thing is, once the knowledge gets out, it's a lot harder to put it back in the bottle. You know, people are like that. Once they know something, even if they don't fully understand it, even if they only have enough to give them a glimpse, oftentimes that forms the nucleus of an exposure that comes along shortly thereafter, simply because they get that feeling that there's more, and then people start digging, you know. And I think that's going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of digging going on.
Yeah.
And thank God for it.
Yeah. Yeah, if I could comment on that just for a moment, Jim.
Sure.
Seems to me, you know, when we take things in the context of the reality that has been created for us and is constantly being tweaked for the purpose of making us less conscious of what's going on, or for the purpose of taking our rights away, and I'm speaking on a global basis now, because it's become that because they've gotten that bold in their declarations of where the world is headed and what their intentions are and all the methods that they use to try to create the fear that this is inevitable. And yet, on another level, if I step outside the emotional aspect of the Matrix, I see that it's merely a matter of opposing vibrations. You have a vibration which is of a low nature, a low quality, devoid of a harmonic structure and devoid of any contact with the source of the creator, or the source of the creation, let's say, which is the creator. And on the other hand, those that are awakening and developing a higher consciousness are moving in the opposite direction. So the shift, or the balance, first of all, is changing. It's shifting more towards the positive. So all these attempts at lowering the frequency are merely lowering the frequency of those that are planning all this and orchestrating it, carrying it out, sort of like the conductor of a symphony. It's a piece of music that nobody wants to hear, you know, and they're investing all their time into trying to sell it to us through repetition and through misrepresentation and disinformation and propaganda and really a void of any consciousness other than to gauge what impact it's having on the mass of humanity. And on nature and the animal kingdom and the earth itself. So I see that the intention to lower the vibration of the earth is being met with what you could say in French, they say secours or help, you know, but it's of a divine nature and they can't stop it. They really can't stop it, and it's going to affect anyone who is looking for answers, or anyone who is fed up with the lies and the misrepresentations and this illusory reality. See, we're moving to as you move toward truth in any topic, really, but certainly those that have been hidden from mankind for the purpose of dumbing us down. As you discover one truth, it leads you to many, many more. It's not discovering one truth leads you to a second one. There are 10 other truths waiting to get at you, or 100 or 1,000, based on that one truth that you finally realized or recognized. And And I think this is where their fears lie, is that they can't stop it, can't really interfere. They're certainly trying, you know, and at every step. And those that are going to look at this from inside the matrix are going to feel and see the fear and not see any solution or any remedy for extricating oneself from it. That's all I want to say.
Yeah, well, I actually agree with that. And frankly, that same principle, I've noticed it directly in my own work. I can't tell you how many times I've been given some kind of an inspiration to investigate an idea. And when I first received the information, my personal evaluation of it was that it was restricted to one particular concept for a certain application. And after I took the trouble of actually looking into it, it was just like you said, it sucks you right in, and you do get the total appreciation of that particular facet of the truth, but then all of a sudden, because you now understand that, it operates like a key, and it opens up many other doors. And, of course, behind each of those doors are other revelations, and it's the type of thing that expands exponentially. And all knowledge is like that if you give it a chance. But you have to be willing to do the legwork. And I think that that's happening now. People are starting to look into things in a way that perhaps they hadn't done before. And it is growing exponentially. And this covers a lot of territory, too, not just the odd things that I'm reporting on here on our show, but you know, in politics, in law, in our everyday life, lots of things are beginning to become exposed, and the more that happens, the more people dig. And you know, it's not long if you plot that activity, you'll find that it definitely represents an exponential curve.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing about an exponential curve is, in the very beginning, the progress is extremely slow, almost imperceptible. And then all of a sudden, when you reach that certain mathematical point of transition called the knee of the curve, after that, it takes off like a bat out of hell. And I assure you, there's no stopping it after that. And I think we're approaching a point like that in our history, concerning many things that have been repressed. And I just hope that we reach the knee of that curve in very short time, because it'll change everything.
Yeah, I see things working sort of in a logarithmic curve, which is increasing in intensity as it rises over
a
shorter span of time, in other words. And like our other sensitivities and in our physiological analyses of how we perceive things, especially sound, what we hear, I think we're inclined to see things not in such straight lines as the computer models paint for us, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, because there are no real straight lines. If human history was truly linear, it would be one of the easiest subjects to master. Just a question of memorizing a bunch of major events, you know. But that's not really how human history unfolds. And people who really take the time to dig into the past are aware of this. So anyway, speaking of Egypt, The other mystery that's right in the same neighborhood of the Sphinx is the Great Pyramid, which has been something else that's attracted me for many years. And while I don't want to go into a lot of speculation about what it really is, the one thing that we know it isn't is a tomb. And yet the traditional archaeologists cling to that understanding that it was a big tomb. just doesn't make any sense. First of all, there was never any body found in it, and no funeral objects, you know, nothing related to the types of burials that we find, for instance, in the Valley of the Kings. And yet, this definition persists because they simply don't have anything else to offer. But there have been several real interesting examinations of the internal structure of the Great Pyramid, which have led some creative people to come up with some interesting theories about what it might have been. And I'm going to mention two of them because they're both kind of interesting and they're very creative. I can't really tell you whether or not they hit the nail on the head or not, because to try it would be an impossible undertaking, not only because most of the technology is now missing or destroyed, but also because the political climate in Egypt concerning these matters is very repressive, and you'd never get permission to do any of this stuff. But one explanation for the Great Pyramid was that it was a water pump. And the theory of this is based on the fact that the underneath portion of it, way down in the bedrock, there's this huge chamber, which at one time may have been connected to the Nile by means of another tunnel. And if this chamber was to flood under the right conditions, the theory is that you would have what they call a ramjet pump. And these ram pumps were really a pretty fascinating discovery. And I've actually seen them in operation, not anything as big as a pyramid, but I mean, they used to have these ram pumps. And basically the way it works is that a flow of water in large volume is encouraged to come down an incline, let's say, or fall from a higher to a lower level. And in doing so, the momentum of the water rushing forward compresses air inside of a chamber, inside the actual physical pump. And this pressurization continues until the air that's in there is under such an enormous pressure that it resists the flow of any more water into the chamber. And once the flow stops, a foot valve closes so that the action can't go back in the direction that it came from. And at this point, the compressed air, once the motion of the water ceases, that becomes the dominant force, and it expands back down and pushes the water out of another valved exit, and that water is then moved at a different volume and a different pressure. So there's no violation of anything. And as soon as that air is expanded to the point where most of the water has been pushed forward, now there's no resisting force anymore. The gate valve swings back open, and the water flow begins to continue the cycle all over again. And what this one guy has hypothesized is that this is the type of action that went on inside the Great Pyramid, and he explained all these various chambers and whatnot were part of this mechanism, and that water was pumped, you know, all over Egypt in that time period from the Nile, basically for free by this mechanism. Now, I don't know if I buy it or not, but I certainly know about a ram pump, and I know that that's legitimate, and it's an interesting idea. It doesn't hurt anything to speculate. The other more recent thing that I read about is that there's a guy who is investigating the possibility that the Great Pyramid was, in fact, a power plant, Now, some of the things that he talks about, I don't agree with, but it doesn't entirely detract from the idea. His concept was that the structure of the pyramid was so large and so heavy that for all intents and purposes, it was like a transducer that captured telluric vibrations from the Earth and focused them into these chambers inside the pyramid where they were converted into, the vibrations were then converted into a different form of energy, possibly pneumatic or hydraulic pressure, and maybe even electrical activity of some sort. And that's an interesting thing, because when I was working with Ivan Sanderson years ago, one of the things that fascinated him were some of the very early hieroglyphs, which seemed to depict men working with high-voltage apparatus of various types and long electrical cables, discharge bulbs, and all sorts of things which you would not normally associate with an ancient civilization that was supposedly just transisting from the, from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age. But nonetheless, the artwork depicts things of a very curious nature which seem to have an electrical taste to them. And if that was true, then obviously they also had a source of electricity. Colonel Fossett said the same thing about some of the ruins in South America. He said that, in his opinion as an engineer, he thought that a lot of these places were lit with electricity. And it really stands to reason that we can't be the first civilization to know about electricity. I mean, if you go back in history, the Greeks knew about static electricity. The Romans had steam engines. I mean, this stuff that's been floating around for years and years and years that certainly had its origins in the minds of other creative people back through history. And there's no reason why a force of nature like electricity wouldn't have been discovered long before Ben Franklin or whoever they tried to pin that discovery on. So.
Yeah. In my own studies on the pyramids and pyramid energy, there are many phenomena that occur in relation to the pyramid being some sort of an energy device. And I think you and I have talked about this on some past shows, but it's worth mentioning for new listeners or anyone that hasn't heard us discuss this. There are descriptions of the animals that sneak into the openings of the pyramid, whether it's the main entrance or openings that have been revealed over time. Certainly there are several openings that align with certain star systems in our galaxy. And so the pyramid has a galactic dimension to it. The precision of these huge rocks that weigh tons and tons and tons, and the bonding material, how thin it is, and yet it can't be replicated. It can't even, you know, they don't even know what's in it. They can't determine what it is, and it seems a bit ostentatious for a tomb. And yet these other phenomena that represent something more to do with other parts of the galaxy and the alignment of the pyramid at certain times of the year or certain points in our history indicate that there's much, much more to it than that. Now, these animals that sneak into the pyramid become emaciated, or they die because they can't get to water, they can't get to a food source, and they can't find their way out. And as a result of that, they they are trapped in the pyramid, and over time they become, and over a very short period of time, they become mummified. And there's actually a series of trash bins outside the entrance to the pyramid where the caretakers, what do you call them, janitors, the people that sort of clean things up, take these animals and throw them into those barrels outside the main entrance, and they don't putrefy. They stay in that suspended state of animation. So there's a great understanding of what types of metaphysical energies a pyramid structure emits. And Patrick Flanagan, who has been developing a lot of technology to overcome disabilities like deafness, for instance, invented a pyramid energy plate. Now, I don't know the specific intended use for that. He was very secretive about that, but I had the feeling that it was something that he had developed for the government. It was a series of pyramids in a grid, tiny little pyramids. And I've seen these with the Federation. I've seen the inside of a Federation ship. In fact, I have the picture on my website for anyone who's interested. It's a picture of a space shuttle launch taken from one of the Federation ships. And I became very interested in this window on the craft that allowed the picture to be taken. And when I zoomed in on the frame of the window, I could see this pyramid energy plate designed just like Patrick Flanagan's. I thought you might find that interesting, that there is a knowledge of pyramid technology that's been incorporated as the interior, you could say, almost like an insulation or an isolation type of material that is used on the interior of these ships.
Yeah, I remember that. And Don, I'm back, by the way. I don't know if you missed me or not, but I got disconnected.
Oh, well, I was describing the energy phenomena that occur with pyramids and Patrick Flanagan's energy plate and how it looked like the inside of the ship.
Yeah, I remember that issue very clearly. Yeah, and there's no two ways about it. There is some kind of an energy associated with the pyramid form. And I think we went into that on one show in considerable detail, and I even exposed the fact that there's a special branch of mathematics that is associated with the Egyptian design concept, which actually is related to the possibility of representing four-dimensional space in three dimensions, which would essentially create a portal of some sort. And allow something to come through and possibly something from this side to go over. And you know that Napoleon was very interested in the pyramid phenomenon. And when he conquered Egypt, one of the things that he did was he actually spent a night alone sleeping in the sarcophagus of the Great Pyramid. And this is a pretty well-known story. And the next morning when people came to see if he was all right, he was as pale as a ghost. And he would never reveal whatever it was that happened to him. And years later, on his deathbed, he began to talk about it. And he said it was the most amazing experience of his entire life. And he said, but there's no point in revealing it even now, because nobody would ever believe it. And that's all we know. But the interesting thing is, something happened. And whatever it was, it greatly affected this guy. And so there's a possibility that this is a machine that has some incredible characteristics associated with four-dimensional space, which might imply such notions as time travel or dimensional displacement or anything of that sort. And Napoleon isn't the only person that talked about this. I mean, the Rosicrucians have information in that respect, and so do the Masons. As a matter of fact, one of the principal rituals in Masonic law revolves around an understanding of a secret ritual called the resurrection. And this is the same resurrection concept which has come down to us from ancient times and wound up in modern Christian philosophy as well, but actually had its roots somewhere in the long distant past, and is associated with the idea that a dead body isn't coming back to life, but what's happening is that an individual who is alive is allowed to die without surrendering the life force from his earthly vehicle. And when that happens, there is an enormous, you talk about an increase in consciousness. Imagine what it would be like if you could go and mingle in the cosmos with the deity and be able to return. And actually, Don, you have some experience in that direction, because you had health issues that almost took your life and you survived it. And didn't you have some amazing experiences on the other side?
Oh, absolutely I did, yes. And I've talked about those a little bit from time to time, which underscores, you know, part of my message that there's nothing to fear about dying. And really, the whole concept of fear is nothing but an illusion anyway. And it becomes very, very clear to you at the most profound level. If you're fortunate enough to come back, you bring that consciousness with you. And if nothing else, you are compelled to share that with others, to convey that message to them. I mean, that's my own personal experience, but in talking to others who have had the same experience or something similar, they tend to concur with that. You know,
absolutely. But here's the thing that's interesting. I don't remember the details of your particular experience, but most people that have these near-death episodes are not trying to induce them. You know, they happen because of health problems or accidents or, brain injuries, whatever. But here might be a mechanism where you can literally make a decision to undergo this broadening of your consciousness. And just by going through the proper rituals in this specially designed space, that you might actually be able to leave your body and have the pyramidal forces preserve it in your absence, so that you can go and commingle with the forces of the universe in return. And I dare say that anybody who does go through an experience like that will never be a normal, quote-unquote, individual again. Because it's impossible for you to evolve and then go backwards after the experience. Once you reach a higher level or a higher octave of expression, it takes a great deal of negative work to bring you back to where you were before.
That's the essence of what I was saying about their intention to lower the consciousness or the vibration of the mass of humanity, not realizing that the few who are awake are awakening to the extent that the energies, the higher energies that they're pulling in their fewer numbers are actually surpassing the impact of what the negative side has created. In other words, it's counterbalancing it, but it's also moving it up to a higher level of consciousness at the same time. And that is happening. And we're, those of us who see this happening and sense that this is happening, see the chaos and the collapse of this arcane system that's been ruling this planet for, going on 500,000 years, if not longer.
Well, all I can say is it's long overdue.
Yeah. Jim, we've got a caller here. He's been patiently waiting for us. We have Drew on the line. Is this Drew Raines, by any chance?
Yeah, this is Drew Malone Raines, 1H, electronic engineer that most people just because I yell and scream about Patriot Informational Radio Network, people forget that I'm an electronic engineer. And I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Straightforward question.
Yeah.
I would like to know why we as Americans have not, or not, I should say, or not, utilizing the simplified movement of manufacturing steam to manufacture electricity for our individual homes. And I'd like to know why you would not, I'm on board with you 100% with everything from Egypt and Egyptology on the creation of energy. Why we're not using the basics of steam to create a steam generator, and we have the knowledge to create a steam generator not more than 6 by 6 or 6 feet by 3 feet by 6 feet in which to create all the electricity every individual home in America. May I ask that question, please, to you?
No.
I mean, you're a fellow engineer. You have got the astute observation of seeing what's going on around the world and from the history, from Nikola Tesla, that people forget that he was the greatest mind this nation ever had, and we abused his knowledge. But the simplification of just steam to create electricity, why aren't we using it?
Well, I can answer that to some extent. You know, I personally had a research project a number of years ago in which I was experimenting with a totally new way of releasing energy from water. And this was even before I studied under Professor Brown, so it has nothing to do with Brown's gas. But basically what it does have to do with is using water as a dielectric in a capacitor that's part of a resonant circuit. And if you use high enough voltages, water is a dipole molecule, as I'm sure you know. And when it's exposed to an electric field, the molecules rotate to align themselves with the external stress lines of the electric field. And in doing so, they undergo an angular displacement. And what I notice that happens is that when you hit the right frequency, if you have a high enough voltage, the water begins to boil, because what happens is that the molecules actually collide with each other as they rotate, and this increased friction generates steam. Now, what's interesting about it is that there's hardly any current involved with this process, whereas in normal electrical dissociation of water by electrolysis, there's a heavy current involved, and so naturally, you know, there's considerable power required. But in this particular approach, the displacement current through the dielectric is very, very small, and yet the temperature gradient can be risen to a very high temperature in an extremely small time period. And this is a very interesting way of producing steam from electricity with a gain. And now you can generate a power through a turbine and then close the loop so that you have a process which might be self-sustaining. But you know what the problem is? Nobody believes you can do any of this stuff. And secondly, the money that it takes to do the experimentation and do intelligent research is made almost impossible for you to obtain unless you happen to be filthy rich to begin with. I mean,
that's been my problem, Jim,
over the years, and many other independent researchers, is the fact that you just can't get any money. And on a similar note, as long as we're on the subject, I'll go further and tell you that when I did meet Professor Brown about 10, 12 years ago before he died, he informed me that some of the research that he had been doing as a guest of the Chinese government in the Mongolian Metals Institute consisted of using Brown's gas generated from water to then vaporize tungsten, which it can do very easily, by the way, and in doing so create a flame that was had a temperature of about 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and that in turn was then used to transfer into a body of water and cause superheated steam, which was then used to drive a turbine. And the amount of electricity that it took to generate the original volume of Brown's gas was minuscule compared to what they got out of it. And the only thing that was consumed was this tungsten wire, which was automatically fed into the arc, you know, by automated means. And the gain was incredible because Brown's gas in a normal environment, just burning in air, has the same temperature of boiling water, so it's about 212 degrees. And yet when you impinge that same flame on a target that has a higher atomic number, like tungsten, for instance, the resulting temperature is off the charts. Some of the highest temperatures ever recorded in the Brown's gas experiments were in the neighborhood of 15,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is awfully bloody hot. And so there's a gain involved in these things, which has to be nuclear. It can't be just ordinary chemical reactions that can produce this much of this greater liberation of energy. So, you know, again, there's all kinds of mechanisms that need to be explored, and I'm with you 100%, but guess what? The same people who control the money are the same ones who want to perpetuate these archaic power systems that we have today indefinitely. And so that kind of research doesn't get funded. It's that simple.
Well, let me tell you something.
If I may add a comment here, going beyond everything Drew said and Jim, they have to figure a way to meter it, you see, to allow this. They have to make the money off of this.
I would like to interject. Forget about they. Let's talk about Jim and Drew and the individual. Let's talk about the simplicity of just a steam turbine. I mean, Jim, I'm on board with you. 1,000,000% with what you said. 1,000,000%. But my personal viewpoint is, why can't we grab a steam generator. Steam generator. And then take the knowledge of others that have the knowledge to create steam that is simplified and combine the two technologies of somebody over in Alabama, for instance, that creates steam, just steam. And incorporate that with somebody in California who builds a steam generator and marry the two technologies together to where we have a mechanism that would create the three-phase electricity. Forget about the fact that we have to create electricity using electricity. Let's say we have a 12-volt battery that is needed to create the startup motor that creates the steam. And we feed back the massive amount of electricity created by the steam generator to recharge the 12-volt battery that feeds the 12 volts of DC power that needed to create the steam, and the steam is fed to the steam generator that creates all the abundance of electricity. Why are we using the simplicity of that fact, sir? May I ask that question?
Well, the normal Carnot cycle has certain inherent losses built into it in such a way that you can never achieve a gain. You're lucky if you break even, and of course you never do. So the problem with the normal arrangement involving steam is the fact that it's a diminishing return on your investment. Now, that doesn't always have to be the case. I have a friend who made a very amazing discovery in the field of thermodynamics that under the proper conditions, you can have a self-throttling system, which means that you don't have to do any work to close the cycle on itself, and yet the system will still produce an output of power. And this guy spent an entire fortune of his own trying to bring this to commercialization, and he met resistance on every single level imaginable, from the patent process to the political process to the commercial process. Nobody wants it. And so, you know, until that mindset changes, it doesn't matter what you know or what you don't know, because the average individual is not capable of doing it, and unfortunately the people who do know are in such a minority that they're very easy to control. And that's exactly what's allowed the status quo to remain unchanged for so many years. There's no reason why the technology can't be implemented. It's been around for a long time. Tesla had an engine that did the same thing with liquid air. And that was back in the 1890s. So yeah. It's not like there's nobody that comes up with this stuff. It's just that the powers that be don't want it. In Tesla's case, they burned his whole laboratory to the ground. And that was the first lab he had in New York City. So, I mean, you know, that sends a very profound message to a person like that. I'm sure he's not going to incur their wrath a second time if he can help it. And, of course, actually he did, because they eventually murdered him.
Yeah. Gentlemen, we have to end the show here.
I would like to give you to have my email address, Jim. I would like for you to get in touch with me, because I have to
end the show right now. I can put you in touch with Jim Murray. That's not a problem. But That's all I need to know.
You're breaking up on my end, and I have no idea why. And I appreciate the opportunity to ask the question. If you would give Jim Murray my email address and get in touch with me, I appreciate it, Jim. And thank you, Jim, for coming on this network every Friday to enlighten the Americans and the world of those that are listening on Blog Talk and on Wind Talkers Radio Network. Your infinite wisdom, because you will, believe it or not, Jim, we're listening around the world, and we appreciate what you've got to say.
Drew, thank you very much. I've got to close out the show now. Jim, I want to thank you for coming on this holiday weekend, and let me just say that this is all about money, and they've got their system set up to sell petroleum. And the infrastructure of selling electricity has been enforced for such a long time, and there's so much money to be made from it, while they secretly advance the types of technologies that Drew is talking about, or way beyond that, actually. We don't even really need the steam. There are other technologies that are available. In the realm of crystals, for example, and they know about these things. Of course, the inherent protections are built into that technology that it can't be misused. They're using it in computers. That's quite obvious. They're already using crystal technology. They're using it in radios and other devices. But it becomes a simple matter of figuring out how they're going to be able to perpetually bill everyone for this, to charge money for the use. It's always about the money, isn't it, Jim?
Amen. I can't disagree with you there.
Well,
always about the money.
Maybe next show we can talk a little bit about your Dynaflux generator. I think Drew and others that are interested in these technologies would find that very interesting.
Well, I'm always interested in discussing those things, as long as I don't say anything to, affect my own proprietary information, I'd be happy to do that.
Yes. Okay. Well, I wish you a great weekend. I look forward to your appearance on Evident Footprints next month. We're already at the close of a month. Can you believe that?
Yeah, I can.
Well, you have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Well, thank you very much, Don, and you take care, and definitely be excited to get back to you on our next show.
Okay. Folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest, Jim Murray. I want to thank those on Wind Talkers Radio Network and BlogTalkRadio.com for carrying this show, as well as Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. Don did the sound tonight while Seth is on vacation. And also, I want to wish everyone in the listening audience a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.